doet daar mee met een groot project waar hij iets over zal vertellen, maar hij vindt het aardig en denkt hier ook om in het algemeen over zijn werk te praten. Vooral over de gedachte erachter, de reden waarom hij geen praatje-plaatje zal halen, of geen dia-vertoning, maar alleen een verhaal van hem over kinderbeest.
Welcome, Richard. I just tried to
can
explain
I have a chair?
That you can have a chair, of course. I hope there's one available.
He seems to be a full house. Maybe he gives some stool.
Is there any?
Thanks. Yeah, fine. I hope you can hear me. Can everyone hear me? Yeah, okay. I haven't got any slides today. What I wanted to talk about was in relation to the idea of making sculpture outside the context that's generated by a museum and a gallery. This is a bit amplified. And I don't have any slides because the I haven't. I'm mainly talking about the ideas on which, from which I work, and I don't have any slides because there isn't that many things made. So what I'm going to do is these notes form, as it were, the basis on which I think I approach the idea of making work in a public situation. And after I've talked about these a bit, I'm going to talk just a little bit about the two proposals I've made for Kaspar Koenig's show in Munster. Okay, so when we when we are approached by the idea of making sculpture in a public place, it seems the absence of the context that's provided by the museum or the gallery seems to generate a different set of circumstances. To put it loosely, public sculpture lands in the street with all the apparent welcome of a piece of dog shit. And to understand the reasons why that might be the case, I think we have to look a little bit into the history of the idea of publicness in relation to sculpture. The source of those ideas lies primarily in the late 18th century, when two or three very important developments occurred. End of the 18th century was the time when the first beginnings of modern scholarship arose. The first museums were founded. This is a note by a friend of the German art historian Winckelmann, Christian von Meckel, who was the cataloguer in the Austrian Imperial Collection in Vienna. He's talking about the use of the building. So the purpose was to use this building so that the arrangement should be as far as possible a visible history of art. Such a large public collection intended for instruction more than for fleeting pleasure is like a rich library in which those eager to learn are glad to find works of all kinds and periods. And this is another note from the historian of the ancient architecture to the King of Prussia. He says, it's beneath the dignity of an ancient monument to be displayed as an ornament. They're a heritage for the whole of mankind. Only by making them public and uniting them in display can they become an object of true study. And every result gained from this is a new gain for the good of mankind. What the important idea here is that is a transition of the idea of the art object into one which is not a not an object made in the service of either a secular or religious power, but as a source of a certain kind of good, a source of educative value. The enormous growth in museums during the 19th century acts as a kind of evidence of the degree to which that idea became a part of the general cultural enterprise, that somehow art was attained this notion of a moral value, and that the conserving and displaying of art was a duty or a duty laid upon the state by that it was a responsibility of the state, or a responsibility of the culture to use cultural artifacts as a means of educating in the sense of improving their moral condition of the populace. The central place in that of classical statuary meant the role that classical statuary played in that, the central place in all the collections of the particularly Greek but also Roman artifacts, was a exemplification of an idea of a society in which an idea of an ideal form of existence happened, so that the elevation of classical Greece to a central place put classical statuary in the middle of this idea, and the enormous growth in museum building and the sort of knock-on effect of that into the whole area of discussion about art led to an absolute proliferation in the 19th century of public sculpture. This is Baudelaire writing in his criticism of the Salon of 1859 about sculpture. The subtext is titled "Why Sculpture is Boring," and he's talking. He says, "You're passing through a great city which has grown old in civilization, one of those cities which harbour the most important archives of the universal life, and your eyes are drawn upwards, for in the public squares, at the corners of the crossways, stand motionless figures, larger than those which pass at their feet, repeating to you the solemn legends of glory, war, science, and martyrdom in a dumb language. Some are pointing to the sky, whither they ceaselessly aspired. Others indicate the earth from which they sprang. They brandish or they contemplate what was the passion of their life and what has become its emblem. Be you the most heedless of men, the most unhappy or the vilest, a beggar or a banker, the stone phantom takes possession of you for a few minutes and commands you in the name of the past to think of things which are not of the earth. Such is the divine role of sculpture." So, the nub of all this is that there was a public place which had ramifications in institutional developments, but also in a public situation in which sculpture, by virtue of its connection to a central body of ideas encapsulated in Greek statuary, had some connection to this notion of an ideal place, an ideal society. Concurrent with, I just ask you to hold that idea for the moment. Concurrent with that development in the late 18th century, two other things were happening, which are intermingled with it. On the one hand, there's the development of the landscape garden, in which as it developed, particularly in England, the place you inhabit, the world, was altered, literally altered in many cases by the movement of great masses of earth, the establishment of artificial lakes, the plantings, monuments, to form a place which had which looked like the places in looked like the landscape which occurs particularly in Claude Lorrain's paintings, and underlying that as a way of doing things is the an extraordinary transference from the notion of the world as being a an objective universe, a place in which you inhabit, in which you do your business, in which you go about from there, to a place which somehow resembles a picture, and that the world thus sort of becomes, instead of being a becomes a source of expression, the nature, the idea of nature is transformed from being a from being a sort of antagonistic entity to being a something which embodies embodies expression, so that nature is seen as being a at the behest of man, rather than as being an antagonist, or even where the where it's seen as antagonistic, the that antagonism is somehow seen as being an expression of human emotion, an expression of the vastness of nature, or the is somehow seen as being in consequence of an aesthetic perception, so that the notion of the sublime, for example, is one where the manifestations of phenomena are man-centered, or are seen as being seen as creating an aesthetic effect, so that nature is removed from nature is somehow removed to culture. To give a sort of more mundane example of that kind of transition, and to try and make it apparent that it has some impact on the way, on the kinds of ways of looking we have as people living at the end of the 20th century. 2 years ago, I was going on holiday in the Lake District in the north of England. It was in April, and as I drove into the as I drove into the Lake District. It was a long drive and I was tired. Looking around, I sort of began to notice there were a lot of flowers everywhere, a lot of planted bulbs, daffodils, on every roundabout and every urban space and in private gardens. The place was absolutely full of daffodils, and my first thought was that there are a lot of flowers there, and then I realised what I was looking at, that there's a very famous poem of Wordsworth's, when he's which is certainly incredibly familiar to an English audience, but may not be so familiar to you. When the poem begins, "I wandered lonely as a cloud, when all at once I spied a crowd, a host of golden daffodils." And the poem, Wordsworth is identified with the Lake District, and the what I was looking at was the transposition of a landscape into the terms of a into the terms of Wordsworth's vision, so that the municipal authorities in the Lake District have sought to identify their place with a particular kind of vision, so that one looks at the landscape in the terms that are generated by a poem. And the this is so that's seemed to me as an incredibly potent example of the way in which somehow an incredibly potent example of the way in which I couldn't look at nature. All what I could see was there wasn't any nature. Somehow it had been taken away from me. That and been replaced by an idea generated from a piece of early Romantic poetry, and further in the landscape garden, dotted around the place, around the garden, are fragments of ancient culture, fake temples, pieces of statuary. So that these, in the theory of landscape garden, act as particular focuses for both for the landscape and as points of pause in your meanderings around this this place which is not nature, but somehow is more nature than nature. So that the as far as I sort of can understand it, the transpositions of the kinds of the ways in which the landscape garden was altered were to make it look more natural than nature, so that the nature becomes this sort of expression of human emotions. The fragments, the pieces of Gothic architecture, the pieces of classical architecture, the pieces of classical statuary, were initially picked up by the first tourists on their trips around the centres of European culture, Greece. Trips around Greece and trips around Rome, carried back to and installed within their within these environments, so that three things seem to be happening. I think we can trace three things to the beginning, the ends of the 18th century. On the one hand, you have the start of the growth of the museums and this notion of goodness or educative value in art. The second, you have transpositions of the notion of landscape, the notion of nature, into one which is no longer neutral, but one which is becomes a part of representation, a part of the cultural discourse. And the third, thing is that initially the touristic enterprise led to appropriations of various artifacts and the transposition of those to another setting, but latterly, as the document or as the pictures of that of those touristic enterprises show, began to be wholesale appropriations of various cultures, so that the growth of tourism, both in the 19th century and increasingly in the 20th century, has been one in whereby the things you see, what you confront, are seen as being pictorial, in a way that appropriates their context or their meaning to a set of values, appropriates one set of meanings to another set of meanings. This appropriates whatever the original cultural meaning might have been to a set of discourses which belong to late 18th century aesthetics. Now, making sculpture sculpture had during the 19th century this extraordinary public role. With the collapse at the end of the 19th century of that notion of absolute value, which is kind of inbuilt into that enterprise, the ground is whipped from underneath the artist's feet, and one is left with the two other categories that I've mentioned. The two other ideas that I mentioned. So that, whereas the museum has retained its, there is a continuity of idea in relation to the museum. Somehow the museum still functions as a place of cultural value, and the whole value of the cultural enterprise within an institutional context is one that is still vital, which is still valid. One is only to look at the kinds of price people will pay for that are being paid for cultural artifacts at the moment to realise that. That the notion of value, the cultural value of these items, is still a central, is still a part of the way we think. So that, and yet, it remains within an institutional context. As I said, As soon as you remove the institution, and do the opposite, transpose of what happened in the 18th century, and transpose the artifact from the museum into the public context, it has the attraction of a piece of dog shit on the pavement. The violent reactions which public sculpture can often raise seem to be an indicator of that procedure, or of that happening. So, what to do about it, and does it matter? It's possible to talk. Where are we? Baudelaire's remarks seem richly ironic now. Baudelaire's remarks about the divine role of sculpture, and yet it still remains a question that one is asked to make a work in a public place, and therefore one is looking for ways in which one can make something which has which has a meaning. There is a that has a that has a place. The continuity of the potency of the ideas of the landscape garden, and the potency of the explosion of tourism, the explosion of the means of reproduction mean that as individuals, when we go around the world, our overriding tendency is to regard the world as image rather than as reality, and perhaps in that lies an explanation for the kinds of disturbance that the placing of the transposition of one object to a from the transposition of of cultural artifacts from the museum into the public space causes, so that whilst we can look at the temples of the Parthenon in terms which have no disjunction with the ways in which we regard the world, we find it very much more difficult to look at, for example, the work of Richard Serra in the same way, and the kinds of antagonism that Serra's work arouses have perhaps roots in that procedure. There are, on the other hand, one can equally well say that the antagonism has to do with people's notion of with the imposition of one man's view, one man's private views onto a public space, and that the
And the publicness of space has a that the antagonism that is focused around Sarah's sculptures in New York have at root a question about the nature of public space and the rights of individuals to to that space, or the rights of somehow kind of a funny kind of privacy in a public space, so that and yet looking at it, trying to look at that more deeply, and it's a good example of a situation. Why is it that something which is both relatively inexpensive and relatively small in scale, in comparison to the kinds of building that go on in a 20th century city, why is it that that this thing should arouse the kinds of opposition, these things should arouse the kinds of opposition they do? What is it in the nature of that of that placement, or in the nature of that public space, which is which generates these sensations the answer as the well no it's the answer an answer may lie in the kinds of disjunctions that are created, so that when we see, or when the occupants of the buildings of the offices in Federal Plaza see the Richard Serra sculpture, there's very simple, perhaps. There are very obvious reasons why they may not like it. It may block their light. It may be an interference in within their habits. Yet the kinds of passion that they've caused to arise are symptoms of something much more profound, of a sense in which that being confronted by that which you don't expect to see and that which you can't appropriate, and that which is difficult to appropriate within the prevailing terms, and I think that the prevailing modes of appropriation generated by mass tourism and the increasing use of reproduced images, or increasing familiarity with reproduced images, causes the confrontation with something which is outside of that boundary, causes ruptures within our worldview, and it's this possibility that seems to constitute an interesting opportunity for making sculpture in a public place. That is the possibility of causing certain kinds of break in our ways of looking. Now, which so that the invitation, for sure, the invitation to and the general and the idea that it is possible to make works of art exist in a public space The source of that invitation is for sure within the context derived from that history of 19th century monument building. The fact is that there is no context of meaning whereby whatever is made can be slotted onto the place, and its meaning understood, so that you have as an artist or as a sculptor being presented with the task, you seem to have the impossible notion, the apparently impossible job of doing two entirely opposite things. Either you can choose to disappear, in the sense that your work is seen as being as belonging to the language of pictoriality, and that it improves the view, or is a means by which or is a means of framing the view, or else it's seen as being something that is unnecessary in some kind of absolute sense, that is an absolute affront to one's notion of that is an absolute affront to the ways in which you look at the world, and it's that kind of and it's that apparent polarity which seems to generate a possibility or a kind of openness in which it may be possible to make something which is which it may be possible to make something which has a meaning, and the meaning which is not specifically generated by the kind of discourse that you get within a museum, or that the museum generates for the objects which it contains. So, within that that sort of broadly speaking is the area of ideas which I've been trying to consider faced with the possibility of making work which exists outside of that of the museum or the gallery situation. The motivations for doing it have to do with, on the one hand, that openness, but also, I mean, have to do with, I mean, there are more selfish desires to do with wanting to make something which has a larger compass that has a larger scale, perhaps, than that is available within an interior situation. So that the when Caspar Koenig asked me to go to Munster with the possibility of making something in relation to an urban situation, that was the kind of body of ideas that I brought with me. I was and am sort of profoundly suspicious of, like anybody else, I don't particularly want to make something which causes me or what I do to be vilified. But there was, on the other hand, it did seem that that it might be possible to make something which had which could work against which could work against the Which could work against my what I think of as my tendon, as the pressure, the kind of the kind of pressure that our habits of thought generate in what we see. So that if there was an openness, or if that openness exists, then the possibility that it holds is one of enormous enormous strength. That is, that if that if the possibility exists, it's there, there is a perhaps a chance that one would be able to put a to put something in the world which there would be a chance that one would be able to put something in the world which unhinged or dislocated one's habits of seeing, and this isn't a this isn't a minor matter. One is continually victimized by received imagery. One's whole understanding of the world and of your and of your place within it is a result of received ideas. The example that I gave, that I tried to give you about the daffodils in the Lake District, is a a consequence of that. So that so that the kind of chink that I'm that I have suggested that the invitation to make something in public gives is one which has potentially immense importance, or has, if not importance, potentially has immense value. So that when, so that that body of ideas was going around my head when I first went to Munster. The work I've done there, and there are two. And I've made two. I've made two works there on two related sites. The first, unlike many other invitations, the first task was to find a place. The invitation was a very open one, in that. One was invited to go to Munster to walk around the city, to become familiar with its architecture and familiar with the, some of its history, and then if you thought that it might be interesting, to then find something which might constitute a site for you, and then to make a proposal in relation to the site, and then with luck the thing to carry the project through. So that I was looking, the kind of place that I was looking for, I think, was something that was a space that was both in public, but somehow not obvious. At that time, I didn't want a the sense in which the normal kind of places in which one finds sculpture in an urban setting, the kind of squares, crossroads, and things, seemed to be far too loaded as places, and to be ones in which one would very quickly become condemned to a the sculpture would have great difficulty in retaining its identity in the face of its of the kind of context which those sort of places generate. So that the two places that I found were both on corners. They're empty. There's a short street, short. Empty lots, and these seem to fulfill very well both that notion of a space that I was looking for, in that they were both public and private spaces, and also to in their being paired to generate a means of articulating a whole section of a whole section of the city, somewhat like the two bookends at the outside of a row of books on a shelf might bracket an urban the bookends bracket the books, so the sculptures might bracket a section of housing. And so I produced two proposals, and the proposals have a relationship in that one is fundamentally the inverse of inverts the relationship of the other, so that in one case there is a large volume constructed out of a skeletal frame which has a smaller element attached to it, and in the other the volume of a frame is reduced to something very slight, whereas an internal volume becomes very massive. And the dialogue between the two parts was I was seeking within the dialogue between two parts to try and talk within the sculpture a bit about the ways in which the kinds of framing device that the museum supplies to an object can perhaps be transferred to an external situation. One of the first places that I saw him once, there was the zoo. It was an old 19th century zoo, and at first I thought that it would be interesting to make, that it might be possible to make a piece of sculpture within one of the cages of the zoo, as a means of trying to render the public context as a means of trying to render, to talk a bit about the rationale behind making something by using a visible parallel or a visible metaphor for habits of vision. Then the transposition of that, so I transposed that idea to the actual site, and have used two parts to each work, as a container and a contained, and then inverted, so that what was the container in one becomes the contained in another. Equally, that question, the formality of those questions. I mean, the obvious question you can ask about the kind of way I presented that has to do with well, what does the formality of that discussion have to do with anything that anybody who isn't a party to the discussions of about 20th century art. 20th century sculpture. How does that relate to them? And yet the notion of the container and the contained within that seems to be both paralleled in an interesting way in one of the existing monuments in the city, and also to be a discussion about experiences of a very everyday sort, so that the attempt within the sculpture, and it's maybe a bit sort of strange talking about something of which you have no visual image, but the attempt within the sculptures was both the kinds of discourse I've laid out, but also in a sense as someone that inhabits a body, that the experiences between my notion of my perception of an external world and my sensations of my body seem to be equally well are ones which I think are part of something which is common, which is how can I put it fairly simply? The object, it seemed to me important that the objects which I made, the sculptures which I made, had several dimensions. There's the kind of formal, the formal dimensions I've just laid out. The second was that by utilizing the two spaces to make things which are of a size comparable to houses, the two works between them are about half the size of the houses that occur in the row. There was a proposition that, and each of them is enterable, in the sense that they have an entrance or they have an opening which would correspond to a door in a house. That one was setting up. I was setting up a situation whereby something that was an object was being regarded as being along the same was regarded as in the same way as one might regard a house, and equally one thinks of a house as being the or a dwelling as being the functions metaphorically in the same way as one thinks of one's body, so that there was a there's a set of alliterations, a set of resonances that I was trying to establish between, on the one hand, the notion of the container and the contained as the as a part of a discourse about sculpture. On the other hand, in the second place, as a discussion about the way in which the relationship between dwellings and objects, and on the third, that the notion of a dwelling can also be regarded as being the dwellings can also be regarded as being in some ways parallel to the notion of a body, so that the kind of form that I've used has strong bodily references. The scale on which the thing is made has strong architectural references, and the place in which the things are situated make an attempt to relate that to some sort of notion, some idea of the city. Following on from my first remarks, that seemed to be that represents for me the first instance, or represents one of the first instances when I've tried to make a transposition between the I've tried to engage with what that idea of openness, that the possibilities of making something in a public space engenders. Of course, there is a I have no claims to answers, but the and there is a discussion that would need to take place about the whole idea of publicness in a space. So that's. That's the theory, and Munster represented and to an extent also the work that I did in Sonsbeck represents a means of trying to engage with that sort of theoretical position in a public space. That's all. Does anyone want to ask questions? Tell me that it's that I haven't understood anything. Refute everything I've said, or. Yeah, Saskia.
What is the main reason that you make two objects or two sculptures? Is that to renounce
the main reason, Saskia, was.
The main reason to have not one object, to do things at the same time is pretty remarkable.
the reason for making two, the practical reason was in part generated by this happy coincidence of sights. I should say that after the two were made, I actually lost one of the sights and had to recite one work across the road from its original position. The notion of two objects forming a bracket seemed to double up on a on some of the when I had two, it called into question the whole notion of uniqueness, that between the two, something like a dialogue emerges, whereas the constraints of the sight, the constraints of a notion of sight upon a single object, seem to have a very different feel to it. There's a book by Lewis Carroll called The Hunting of the Snark, and it's a long nonsense rhyme, but throughout the throughout the poem, there's a man who rings a bell, and what he says is, I've told you once, I've told you twice, what I tell you three times is true. And within the I have a feeling that in the position that we live in, towards the end of the 20th century, that many notions which were previously held to be unquestioned become very much more difficult to get at. So that an idea like authenticity, for example, seems to become only it seems to be only possible to talk about something like authenticity in an ironic context. It's a we seem to operate in a time when it's very difficult to speak other than elliptically about notions like truth or authenticity or value, and so that the in a paradoxical way, the repetition and artificiality become somehow almost more real than the real, so that the idea of making two objects seem, which aren't identical, but the idea of making two objects seem to be to have a certain element of that within it, by doubling up both their artificiality and their meaning, could perhaps be more clearly identified, so that somehow artifice becomes an indicator of the artifice, and the indication of artifice becomes a sort of one way of talking about elliptically about something else, so that the second idea which appealed to me very strongly was had to do with this, as I say, with the notion of a bracket, so that as in a the brackets that surround a speech reporting. Reporting speech, so that reporting dialogue, so that what the work seemed to be doing was bracketing a piece of urban architecture and rendering the rendering the architecture as a kind of quotation. And equally, one can think of the museum as functioning in that way, as a kind of bracket, in which it's possible to engage in certain kinds of discourse. Without that discourse having a and yet if you remove the bracket, the discourse becomes. Meaningless or unintelligible, so that the it was the two were intended to do to sort of to invert that relationship by making a by making a bracket for a piece of urban speech to render the urbanity of the the urban situation artificial in the same way as one can think of the, as the of the museum situation as artificial, and therefore to invert the kinds of notions of reality. One thinks of the street as being real, and the museum as being. I tend to think of the street as being real, and the place of the museum or the place of the gallery as being somehow detached from that reality. Does that answer?
Yes. Can you say something about the room that Sarah? Obviously, that was a bit in your mind about something that I don't know whether you. Obviously, it had caused a lot of controversy, and you didn't. I wasn't sure.
Do you know?
About wanting to unhinge people's expectations with what you were doing. I wanted to know what you felt about the Richard Serra and why you think it provoked the sort of responses it provoked, and what you've done in order to deal with the problems that he.
Well, I think I mentioned the Serra as an example of. The kinds of response that a piece of sculpture in a public location can cause, and the I mean there are in relation to the Serra. There are an enormous number of arguments, both to do with the kinds of both the legal arguments to do with contractual obligations, and the more profound arguments to do with why it is that something within a within an urban situation, or within a public situation, causes particularly violent reactions when, by comparison with architectural elements, which are continuously being springing up, the kinds of but are accepted. I mean, there seems to be a curious disjunction between the fact they could make this rather awful building, and that somehow okay, but then the sculpture is not okay. I find myself slightly I think that the reaction that one also has to distinguish between the reactions of people who live and work in a place from the more general context, so that in relation to the Federal Plaza project, and I'm not the in the I suppose in the end I think that the I think it's a very, very interesting area, a very tricky kind of area. I think that in the end, in relation to something like the Federal Plaza project, where people who lived and worked in a space had a particular habit of had grown habituated to it, that they finding that they had an antagonistic reaction and a continuing antagonistic reaction to the sculpture seems to count for a lot in my mind. That's aside from the more general argument, so that you shouldn't take my remarks as being ones which are wholly supportive of the imposition against people's wishes of things in their environment. But what seems to be interesting in the case is the is that it does raise all the questions about the possibilities of making sculpture in a public place. So I raised it as an example that I thought you'd probably know as an audience of the kind of reaction that that can happen. I mean, it's certainly in England, the level of destruction that happens to sculptures that are put up in public places, whether they're there temporarily or permanently, is quite astonishing. The and this isn't just a question of the odd bits of graffiti. It's a question of violent damage attacks upon the and personal attacks upon and bodily attacks upon the artists involved. It's against that it in the English press, in the British press, public sculpture seems to occupy a place somewhat below that of child murderers as a source of as a source of antagonism, and since I didn't think as an audience you'd be so you'd be particularly aware of that, I thought the Sarah, the controversy of the Sarah, was probably a better example to choose. The interesting things, I mean, there's a formal answer to the question to do with the way in which the, in an interior situation, the skin of the exterior surface of a piece of work functions more like an envelope and less like a solid. There's a in Munster, a part of my interest in the sites have a characteristic of being open and closed, so that I wasn't interested to work in a park in Munster, not so much because of the open space of the park, but more to do with wanting to make work that was within a truly within an urban situation rather than in the park. The use of in Sonsbeck the use of two elements was in part to as a formal the formal device of the two elements whatever I mean had the formal reason for using the two elements was to try and mitigate that the tendency of things to disappear in a very open setting, so that but I was also trying to make reference to the way in which the park itself is a contained is a container. So what was the question? So that in Munster, apart from the kind of ideological reasons I've laid out for choosing the sites, there does seem to be an added bonus in that the architectural the remnants of the architectural frame that the two sites provide do allow for the scale of the work to be seen against to be seen in comparison to something which has a similar sort of scale. the difficulty within a much more open situation has to do with generating scale on a sufficient level to for the object to not to drift away, but at the same time equally to make something which doesn't obliterate the viewer as a in terms of its scale. I mean, I think there are. I mean, those are obviously formal issues, which I think the work tries to deal with. The meaning that openness has is a sort of another question.
Non-public sculptures, do you make them, you mentioned the gallery or the museum, but do you make them for one museum in particular or one gallery, or do you make them for just the museum or a gallery?
Both. I've tried to make I work fairly continuously in the studio, so that there is a fairly abstract notion of place and of the kind of location that the work would end up in. I also have tried to make work which was intended for domestic locations, I suppose in a way that my ideas have been to try and that at one point I realized that the size of the work that I was making determined the location which it might end up, i.e. that the work had a sort of museum or gallery size, and it was at that point that I began to make things which were both larger and smaller than that, you know, so that it was an attempt to see what the possibilities were of making a sculpture that was broader in relation to its idea of final place than the museum or the gallery. I also work in relation to particular places, you know, so that. I may well work in if I'm making something for a particular location, I will work in relation to the notion of the dimensions of that place. Okay.
Shall we continue the conversation in the bar?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You were in PS1?
Yes, I am. And actually, it's used to be
a I was very happy to hear
that. I thought it was the most beautiful I had ever seen in my life. I was there for a short talk with Tony Craig and the English Cultural
I met you in very briefly in the tunnel.
Yeah.
But I couldn't hear a word.
No. How could I? So afterwards I wanted to ask what you that I had left. I couldn't even hear your name. I didn't stay there for a long time, just when I come back to the time. Are you looking at the
just here with Marianne last year.